Welcome to today's episode of Literary Ear, titled Healing Hands, brought to you from the Perth studios of Vision Australia Radio. My name is Maureen Tavani, and today, reading with me is Amanda Marsh. Hippocrates of Kos, also known as Hippocrates II, was a Greek physician of the classical period who is considered one of the most outstanding figures in the history of medicine. He is traditionally referred to as the father of medicine in recognition of his lasting contributions to the field, such as the use of prognosis and clinical observation, the systematic categorization of diseases, or the formulation of humoral theory. I have chosen the theme Healing Hands to pay tribute to the numerous people in all fields of medical care, too numerous and varied to name or describe. This episode will showcase two books featuring two extraordinary doctors. Under Her Skin, featuring Professor Fiona Wood by Sue Williams, and The Barefoot Surgeon, The Life Work of Dr. Sanduk Ruwet by Ali Gripper. The late Fred Hollows said of The Barefoot Surgeon, "If I have done one thing in my life I am proud of, it is launching Ruwet into the world." What a great testimonial. Since the apocalyptic destruction of life in Bali 20 years ago, Professor Fiona Wood's groundbreaking research and technological development has changed the lives of burns patients. One of the survivors of that dreadful night, Peter Hughes and his son Lee, are well known to my family. This poem, published in NewYorker.com, was written by a young doctor who gave it to his terminally ill patient, who was also a poet. Annals of Medicine. A doctor, a patient, and their poetry. In some ways, writing was the best treatment. By Ofole Magbako. I take an oath rooted in her spirit, bathed in Hippocrates' poetry, to devote myself to her music, to learn the arc of her story, to widen the pools of my mind. I stare into a midnight river, carrying strips of moonlight through the city, reflecting the hopes of a young healer, first to heal himself, to turn the world towards brighter dawns, to find truth in the opening of my heart.
The 12th of October 2022 marked 20 years since so many lives were altered forever in the Bali bombings. Professor Fiona Wood has been instrumental in improving the lives of many of those victims who, through the work of her hands, became survivors. The following is a review from collinsbooks.com.au. Under Her Skin, The Life and Work of Professor Fiona Wood AM, National Living Treasure, by Sue Williams. This is the remarkable story of Professor Fiona Wood AM, world-leading burns specialist and one of Australia's most innovative and respected surgeons, whose groundbreaking research and technology development has changed the lives of burns patients. When three bombs tore out the heart of Bali and destroyed so many Australian lives in 2002, burn surgeon Professor Fiona Wood and her team were there to help 28 survivors with up to 92% burns to their bodies. A pioneer in the field of burns and reconstructive surgery, Fiona made world headlines with the use of her groundbreaking invention of spray-on skin to help minimise her patients' terrible scarring. Fiona was later made Australian of the Year, voted Australia's most trusted person for an unprecedented 6 years running in the annual Reader's Digest poll and acclaimed as National Living Treasure. This is the story of her extraordinary life. Against all the odds, Fiona, the daughter of a fifth-generation coal miner in the north of England, became one of Australia's most innovative, respected and dedicated surgeons and researchers. She talks candidly of the moving valour of her burns patients and the heartbreak, triumph, tears and controversies that have stalked her stellar career. Remarkably, she has achieved all of this while raising six children. In Under Her Skin, Sue Williams, a best-selling author and award-winning journalist who has written a number of biographies, most notably about Father Chris Riley, Father Bob Maguire and Dr. Catherine Hamlin, presents a searingly honest, no-holds-barred account of all aspects of Fiona Wood's remarkable life. And now here is a recent interview Maureen conducted with Professor Fiona Wood.
On Literary Ear today, our very special guest is Professor Fiona Wood AM, recipient of many awards, not the least the 2005 Australian of the Year and of the 2003 Australian Medical Association's Contribution to Medicine Award. As mentioned in my introduction, Fiona is also the subject of a new release biography, Under Her Skin, written by Sue Williams. Welcome, Fiona.
Thank you very much indeed.
I believe you're in Broome.
Yes. It's very warm and sunny here in Broome today, yes.
Oh, how lovely. Fiona, I applaud you on so many levels, not the least of which is being the mother of six, and I believe now grandmother to four.
Well, I've just had the fifth arrive today.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. That's wonderful.
That's very special. Yes, thank you.
I believe we do have one thing in common, twin grandchildren.
Yes. The four-year-olds are twins, yes.
Yes, I have identical twin boys who are 37 next week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Fiona, I have really thoroughly enjoyed reading Under Her Skin over and over. How did the book come about?
Well, a little bit of a long and shaggy dog story, really, because Sue first emailed me, as she reminded me only recently, 17 years ago. And I said, oh, thanks, but no thanks. And over and over, over those years, it kept coming round. And then about a year ago, we were sitting back and looking at succession, really, and looking at how we can keep the research going into the future. And Marie is a scientist I worked with a long time ago, assigned our intellectual property to our foundation so that the royalties would go into the foundation so that we would have a capacity of independent research funding. And so Di, who runs the foundation, and Sue said, well, why don't we do the book and the royalties could go through to the foundation. So they kind of got me over the line eventually. And I said, oh, Sue, you don't need to talk to me about it. You talk to all the people I know and look at it from different people's perspectives. But it wasn't that easy. She did circle back to me a few times, as you can imagine.
And also, you managed to fit all of that into your incredibly busy life.
Yes. It was. I am very blessed because I have great support around me. And Di from the foundation did a lot of work with Sue. And then a friend of mine, Claire Kuzich, I've known for very many, many years since we were both in London together, really did the hard yards on the proofing and bringing things to my attention that she thought needed my eyes. And so, no, I'm very blessed to have such great support, and others, of course, but Claire really stood out for doing the hard yards there for me.
When you were growing up as a coal miner's daughter in a small pit village in the north of England, you developed a mantra, set no limits. How or why did that happen?
Oh, well, because I always tell my mother, you brought me up to leave. But I think I'd seen things happening around me. And we were brought up with an understanding that the world was a big place. And it was ours to go and explore if we just had to have the courage to grasp it. You know?
In chapter 2, Never Settle for Second Best, I like this piece, you drew on boxing lessons you had watched your brothers having and took on the school bullies to protect a small girl. I would love to have seen that. Do you remember the day?
It's interesting because I'm sending Sue to speak to others about me is positive and negative, isn't it? And yes, I do. I do remember the day, and I do also remember it wasn't an isolated incident. I abhor bullies. It just doesn't sit well with me at all. So there were times along my life where it just had to be pointed out. And if it was to the detriment of me, so be it. But I think, we've heard many people talking about this, and particularly more recently, the whole concept of the behaviour you walk by is the behaviour you accept for yourself, and how we have a responsibility, all of us, to call out. It's not easy to call poor behaviour, but unless we do, we accept it.
Yes.
And, that's kind of in my DNA, I think, yeah.
And at 17, you received a UK government university grant to pay tuition fees at St Thomas's Hospital, was it, medical school?
Yes.
Yeah. And you were only one of 12 women amongst 60 men. And is this where your love of surgery was born, or had you developed that earlier?
Oh, no, I had no idea about surgery at all, really, or medicine, to be perfectly honest.
Cross-stitch.
In those days, I mean, if you were a kid at school who was doing well, you did law or medicine, didn't you? You know, and I was definitely couldn't spell, so I was definitely not on the law side of things, whereas science and math absolutely intrigued me. So you're on that trajectory. So I turned up, but I was fascinated by it straight off the bat, the whole concept of human anatomy and the body and the structure. And I thought, well, if the surgeon puts this back together, then that's what I'm, that's me, that's where I'll be. Yeah, so I, with the insight of a NAS, straight in.
When you were cramming for exams, and that can have its advantages and disadvantages, but it certainly had an advantage for you in the shape of Tony Kyrus, the man who happened to be an Australian. The examination might not have been chemistry, but clearly there was chemistry, because 3 weeks later you agreed to marry him.
Yes, it was a bit of a whirlwind, but, you know, 37 years later, it's probably one of the best decisions of my life, I think. If not the one, happen to say it's probably the best decision of my life.
Had he mentioned coming back to Australia before or after you said yes?
Oh, it was all such a whirlwind and a blur, but, I mean, it was an adventure as well, you know. I mean, I was, like I say, I've never shied away from jumping in with 2 feet, clearly. And so I thought, all right, well, that's interesting. And so Australia was the other side of the world. It was a long way, still is a long way from everywhere, but it was a bit harder and a bit more expensive to get around in those days. So I thought, well, yeah, let's give that a go. He was very upfront that it was, you know, Australia was the place we would be bringing up our children. And I'm very grateful for that. I think it's, you know, an extraordinary place, and I'm extraordinarily lucky.
We are extraordinarily lucky that we have you here. Fiona, in your book, you talk about a young boy you met at East Grinstead, and he changed your life forever. His story makes harrowing reading. I read that, and you quoted in the book after meeting him, "It hit me straight between the eyes that this boy would never move properly again." Can you tell us a bit about him and the photo that you keep on your desk?
Well, that's a photo that certainly these days is in my computer and still is. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where you think, whoa, is that the best we can do right here, right now? And it was in the 1980s. And I think we've got to be able to do better than this. I think in some ways that was a very naive comment on one level, because, you know, people had worked very hard to get to the point where, you know, surviving from burns and, you know, pain management and, you know, in all of the complexity of care that needed to be pulled together to get someone through this injury. So it was naive in that, you know, I didn't have the insight at that level at that time. But equally, it taught me that one of the most important things in whatever we do is the recognition of the need to do better. Now, if we accept that this is as good as it gets in whatever we're doing, then how will we ever, you know, we may stumble across something that, oh, gosh, that might be better and try it. But in fact, if we accept the status quo as only today's knowledge, then we're beholden to look for tomorrow's knowledge, yeah? And so even though I was naive in the way I articulated at that time, it's still a thing that stays with me. That, you know, we should be able to learn from today to make tomorrow better. And part of that is the recognition that, you know, with our education and training comes a level of responsibility. You know, responsibility to our patients to see, well, what else can we do? Where else can we go with this? And we see that all around us. I mean, you look at people, how people survive the death, particularly children's cancer, not often, but a lot better than they used to. Well, that doesn't come from accepting today. It comes from a questioning, learning. And I'm absolutely acknowledging today, but learning so that tomorrow is better. So I think, as I say, I articulated poorly at that time, but I think it still is a mantra that stays with me.
In chapter 20, Tough Love, when Peter Hughes, who happens to be a dear friend of one of my families, was finally transferred to RPH from Adelaide about 5 weeks after the Bali bombing, he is quoted in the book as saying, "That first meeting was bloody interesting. She scared the shit out of me." Clearly it worked. Do you often have to resort to tough love?
Oh, I think, it was interesting because you develop relationships with people, and I think you look back and you think, oh yeah, I was a bit firm. But I mean, I could see a strong, fit man there. That they've done a great job in Adelaide, and just come on, sweetheart, just get out of bed. You can do this, you know, and give, you know, to drive that level of self belief again, which he's got in spades. Absolutely extraordinary.
Yes,
yet at that time, I don't think I went in. Yeah, I didn't actually tip him out of bed.
I think you told him he had to get up and walk.
Yes, I was pretty firm that there was, you know, his legs were okay and he could actually use them. And so I think, it's when needs must, I think. You know, you're just like, well, you've been in bed a little bit now. Times have come, love, to get up.
Well, we as a family are very, very grateful for that tough love.
Thank you.
In May 2021, the McComb Foundation became the Fiona Wood Foundation. Your Australian mentor, Harold McComb, would say, always learn something today to make tomorrow better. How do you interpret those words?
Well, I think that's, as I've been saying, it's actually not criticising today, it's acknowledging that you stand on the shoulders of giants that have gone before. We've heard that said many, many times. And it's acknowledging the energy that gets us to this point. But in acknowledging the energy and the intellect and the sheer, you know, the sweat that's got us to this point in whatever endeavour you have, there comes with that, in my view, a level of responsibility and duty to then add to it. And so that's what he instilled in me.
Fiona, you're working, I believe, with a group of researchers in a world-first clinical trial to test new drugs. Is it Pharmaxis and Ilox?
Pharmaxis is the company, and it's what we call a LOX inhibitor. It's changing the bonding of the protein collagen within the scar. Yeah, we're trying to unscar the scar. So that's really exciting.
Fiona, I'm so happy that you were dared to dream, that you thought outside the box, and you are giving your gift to so many people. We are also very grateful to you, and thank you for giving us your time in a very busy life.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your interest.
Under Her Skin, published by Allen and Unwin, is available now in paperback, on Kindle, and in audio form via Audible. All the proceeds from Under Her Skin will go to the Fiona Wood Foundation to continue to reduce suffering from burns injuries in the future. I hope you are enjoying this episode of Literary Ear on Vision Australia Radio, VA Radio Digital, and online at varadio.org.
This tribute from the Australian journalist Ray Martin is featured as part of the prologue of The Barefoot Surgeon on pages 12 and 13. Fred Hollows and Sandok Ruart were true soulmates, but now here is Ruart a couple of decades later and he's gone out and he's actually done it. It was Fred's imprimatur that got him launched, but Ruart just kept plugging away. He raised the money, built the hospital, trained the surgeons and held the camps. Ruart has almost halved blindness in Nepal and is spreading his technique to other countries. It is amazing to think that in my lifetime, or in my children's lifetime, we will see cataract blindness ended. People will keep getting cataracts, it's part of the ageing process, but Ruart and the army of surgeons he is training are putting a lid on it. What Ruart has achieved is well beyond Fred's wildest dreams. Ruart went on to become a godlike figure who looks after the blind. He reminds me a lot of one of the other remarkable men I have interviewed, Don Bradman. They both had a God-given talent and skill that they both have harnessed in a highly disciplined way. Bradman had no ego at all. He just knew he was a fantastic batsman. Ruart is also clearly a man without ego and a man with immense self-respect. He does not need to boast about how good he was. He didn't ever need to tell people he was a brilliant surgeon. He just is. He is very humble, but he certainly knows his place in medicine. He doesn't dismiss winning the Nobel Prize as ridiculous. He has got great self-respect. I have covered so many fascinating stories in my life, and I will never forget the joy on the patients' faces at an eye camp Ruart held in Myanmar a few years ago. Ruart did 600 operations that week, and there was this incredible collective joy as he looked at the rows and rows of his patients who could see again and who were absolutely jubilant. They just sort of broke into dance and song. The surgeons watching him work were just in wonderment at the pace and meticulousness of his surgery. He's just so fast. We put a clock on him to watch him. He was doing operations in about 5 minutes, and the other doctors were doing it in about 15 minutes. It was just astonishing to be standing there and watching. The following prologue from The Barefoot Surgeon, pages 14 to 17, tells the experience of Kanchi Maya.
The Barefoot Surgeon by Ali Gripper, published by Allen and Unwin. Prologue. The morning sun was just beginning to light up the snow peaks of the Himalayas in northeastern Nepal as Kanchi Maya's brother brought her to the small community ice centre. In the custom of the region, he carried his adult sister on his back in a large wicker basket attached to his forehead on a trunk line, a mode of transport known as basket taxi. Kanchi was in patched clothes, her body rail thin from malnutrition. After her brother lowered her onto the ground, she shuffled timidly with bare feet toward the eye camp, holding her brother's hand for support. Beside her was her young daughter, who carried her sickly baby brother. Despite being swaddled tightly in a blanket, the one-year-old boy looked close to perishing. One of the assistants gently led Kanchi to Dr. Sanduk Ruit's operating table. He asked her how she made a living. Shaking with nerves, she whispered that she had been trying to support her children by growing maize and tending goats. She had been blind in both eyes for almost 4 years and had never seen her son. Like so many blind women in the developing world, she had been rejected by her husband and his family after she had lost her sight and was no longer useful. She had been taken in by her brother instead. Ruit examined her eyes, which were clouded with the large pearly discs that signify advanced cataracts. He knew that if the operation went well, Kanchi would be able to see clearly the next day. An anaesthetic block was given under the sides of her eyes. Half an hour later, a nurse swabbed the rust-brown antiseptic over Kanchi's eyes and draped a green cloth with a hole cut out around the eyes. "Don't be scared," Ruit told her as he separated her eyelids open with a small wire speculum and then patted her gently on the shoulder. "There is no pain and I am going to give you your sight back." He lowered the microscope over her eye and went to work. He quickly removed the first cataract, as hard as a walnut, and replaced it with a plastic intraocular lens, which had been specially measured for her, smaller than a contact lens. The incision he made in her eye was so small and delicate that it would seal without stitches the next day. 10 minutes later, the assistant lifted Kanchi up, turned her around, then lay her down on the other side of the table so Ruit could operate on her second eye. Once it was over, Kanchi shuffled out, led by two assistants, to the recovery room, where she and her family were served the local staple dinner of dal bhat, lentil soup and rice, washed down with cups of chia, the sweet, milky spiced tea the Nepalese drink all day. Kanchi's reaction the next morning, as the bandages and plastic caps over her eyes were removed, was spellbinding. At first she squinted, looking confused as she tried to take in her surroundings. As her line of sight extended and the realization dawned that she could see, tears of joy rolled down her broad cheeks. Ruit lifted Kanchi's baby out of his cradle and into her arms. She held her little boy up close to her face, looked at him incredulously, and kissed him softly. She was too overcome to talk, but her face, alight with love and wonder, told 1,000 words. Seeing Kanchi kissing her baby, that's what sight is all about. It's all about seeing loved ones again properly, Ruit says. The surgeon's smile that day was as broad as Kanchi's. After more than 120,000 similar operations in Nepal and hundreds of similar outreach camps throughout the world, after being showered with awards and accolades for pioneering this unique small incision cataract surgery, It is still his patients' beaming faces that gives Ruart the greatest satisfaction in life. What he loves more than anything else in the world is giving the gift of sight to people who would otherwise have been completely overlooked and who are sometimes left in back rooms to die. He knows only too well that being blind in a country like Nepal absolutely devastates the lives of people like Kanchi. The steep, narrow mountain roads are dangerous to navigate. The blind have no braille, no guide dogs, no white canes, and no special skills. They often cannot afford the bus fare to Kathmandu or a local clinic. Despite the image of village life as a supportive community, the harsh reality in countries like Nepal is that if the blind cannot contribute to their family's subsistence farm, they are often shunned as just another mouth to feed. For more than three decades, Ruart's mission has been to take his life-transforming operations to the blind. He calls them children of a lesser God. No road has ever been too far or too steep. Kanchi could easily have been Ruart's sister, his mother, his aunt or his neighbour. Ruart knows these people. He has lived their life. And that was The Barefoot Surgeon by Ali Grepper, pages 14 to 17.
St Luke is revered as the patron saint of doctors, where we'll close this episode with a blessing for physicians. May you always heal and be healed. May those who come to you find in you one who cares deeply, whose knowledge includes knowledge of the Spirit's movements. May you take pride in your gifts and use them humbly. May the suffering and the vulnerable be your teachers. May you see in others the goodness of a tender God. May compassion encircle you, carry you, strengthen you, and give you insight. May your presence be hope to those in pain. May your skill ease the way and instill trust. May you know the healer of all. May your own heart be held in the compassion and tenderness of God.
Both the books featured today are available in audio form. On Literary Ear, I am Maureen Tavani and was joined today by Amanda Marsh. Our very special guest was Professor Fiona Wood. Please join us at the same time next week on Vision Australia Radio, VA Radio Digital, and online at varadio.org.